Exodus chapter 21. Tonight we have an opportunity to look at a lot of laws. What we're about to read was written over 3,000 years ago. And some of these things written, you'll read them and go, I don't get that. But if you had lived at the time that they were written, you would have understood much more than we do now. And while culture changes, and certain laws that fit in certain cultures and at certain times, well, some are still on the books and they really don't apply directly. But here, while some of these may fall into a culture some 3,500 years ago, the principles behind these laws are eternal. Because what we looked at last week, the Ten Commandments, the standard of holiness, the measure of sanctification. And we saw last week that while we're not saved by obeying the law, it yet is the mark that we strive for. We strive to be like Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ kept the law. And so this is our standard. You can divide the Mosaic Law into three broad divisions. The first is the moral code. That's the Ten Commandments. That's the basis for all of these commands that we're about to read. The basis of them is the Ten Commandments. The second division is the civil code. And all we'll read tonight is part of that second division, the civil code. It's civil law. And then there's a third division. And the third division you especially find in Leviticus, the ceremonial part of the law. So three divisions. And tonight, we read a lot of the itemized civil laws. Now, before we read it, just one more thing. You might want to note 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 8. I'm going to read it for you. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 8. Here's what the Apostle Paul says. A man that knows that we're not saved by law, but the law is the standard of holiness nevertheless. We know that the law is good if one uses it properly. We also know that the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy, the irreligious, for those who kill their fathers and mothers, for murderers, for adulterers and perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to the sound doctrine that conforms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God entrusted to me. The law is good if we use it properly. We don't use it to say, you've got to keep the law in order to go to heaven. No, we go to heaven by grace through faith in the one that has kept the law. But again, though not saved by law, the law is the standard we look to. Chapter 21, verse 1. These are the laws you're to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone. But if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. You say, I don't get this. Well, I told you in the introduction, if you had lived in this culture, you would get it. And if you were one of these Israelites that were hearing these words from Moses, where did you just come from? You just came from slavery. And isn't it wonderful of the Lord that the first thing He mentions to these former slaves, over 400 years they were slaves in Egypt. And God graciously, miraculously delivers them. And the first thing He says now in terms of law, based on these Ten Commandments, and now here's how it works out in everyday life. And the first thing he mentions is a law on behalf of the slave. He said, well, they're free now. Yeah, but even in the law. For example, you might want to write down, and we got a lot to go through, so I can't turn to a lot of them tonight, but Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 39 is one way that a Hebrew, an Israelite, could become, once again, a slave. If you were in extreme poverty, you could sell your liberty. But you see, you look at this and say, well, this is slavery, but wait a minute, wait a minute. Cultures in this day, and if you look at ancient culture, slaves were not considered people. Even in our own history, not too many years ago, America did not give slaves rights. They weren't considered human beings in that way. And so what God's doing here is He's making a law for the slave that if you ended up finding yourself in extreme poverty and you had to sell your liberty now to pay your debt, you didn't have to be a slave indefinitely. 6 years you would serve. And then under the law, you had to be set free. That's the law. What a wonderful thing. It's a law for the slave. Another way you could become a law is by selling your children. God's not saying you ought to sell your children, certainly, but sometimes you want to. A third way was bankruptcy. That's 2 Kings chapter 4. And a fourth was just to pay back something you owed. Verse 5, if the servant declares, I love my master, my wife and children, and don't want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be a servant for life. What a great thing here, too. You see, if you didn't want to stay with that master, the law said 6 years, you couldn't be a slave for more than 6 years. And then you had to be set free under the law. But if you liked the situation you were in, and you loved your master, and let's say you ended up getting married to a slave also there that he owned and was working for him, then you had children during that 6 years, and you loved where you were, then you have the freedom. You have the freedom either to be set free, or you have the freedom to say, no, I don't want to go. I want to stay with you. I want to continue to serve you. Now that's very interesting, especially in light of Psalm 40 and verse 6. Listen to Psalm chapter 40 and verse 6. You'll remember this psalm. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you've prepared for me. But wait a minute, before it says that one, that verse, that's the next verse. Listen, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have pierced. This is a messianic psalm. This is speaking of Jesus Christ, who when He came, we know in the Garden of Gethsemane, He said, if there's any other way, but not my will. In John chapter 6, verse 38, Jesus said, I have come down from heaven not to do my will, but the will of Him who sent me. And Jesus Himself, even though He could have been set free, on the cross, He said, listen, He said, I could call upon my Father, He would send legions of angels and free me. But it's my pleasure to do the Father's will. And He became what the New Testament Greek term refers to as a doulos. And the Apostle Paul, when he writes Romans chapter 1, verse 1, he says, Paul, a doulos of Jesus Christ. You could have continued to go your own way. And you can, even now, if you choose, go your own way. But if you understand what a good master you have, And what a wonderful family this is to be a part of. Then you'd be foolish to leave. Pierce my ear. Run it through. Put the mark of ownership. And there's where we get that phrase, earmarked. We're earmarked for God. Verse 7, if a man sells his daughter as a servant, she's not to go free as men servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her. Again, you read it on the surface, you say, oh, that sounds terrible. Father selling his daughter. Wait a minute. You have to understand the culture. And in ancient times, not only would they sell their children, sometimes as slaves, sometimes because they had to, sometimes because they wanted to. And in so many cultures, again, there were no laws for the slave. And here's another one. This is a positive thing. You say, look, you end up getting this servant, and many times you would get this servant actually for your son, for his wife, and sometimes as a wife for yourself. But after you now purchase her, after you pay the money, and then you realize, well, I don't want to go through with this. And what God is making here is a law saying, wait a minute, you might have changed your mind, but you still have to fulfill your obligation, at least materially, at least financially. Look, verse 9. If he selects her for his son, he must grant her the rights of a daughter. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. In other words, you have got to take care of her even if you're not going to officially marry her. Because that was your commitment. If he does not provide her with these things, she is to go free without any payment of money. It's for the slave, not against the slave. Verse 12. Anyone who strikes a man and kills him shall surely be put to death. However, if he does not do it intentionally, but God lets it happen, he is to flee to a place I will designate. And God designated those places in Numbers chapter 35 and Joshua chapter 20. They're called cities of refuge. But if a man schemes and kills another man deliberately, premeditated, take him away from my altar and put him to death. Now you see how you can go back to the Ten Commandments and see where these laws are directly connected. Because some people will read chapter 20, verse 13 of the Ten Commandments and say, see, God says you shall not kill. And they will argue you should never go to war. They will argue against capital punishment. They will argue against killing of any kind in any way of another human being. But God clarifies. Premeditated murder. Under the law, God says, no mercy. You say, well, should we do that today? Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, God lays down the authority before the law that if man sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Romans chapter 13, verses 3 and 4. The authorities that we have, the laws, are established by God. And he that has that authority does not bear the sword in vain. The sword is representative of death and capital punishment. And biblically, there is strong argument for when there is premeditated murder, that government, established and ordained by God, has not only the right, but the responsibility for capital punishment. And if we would go by the biblical principle, you'd see crime and murder rates go down in America, just as they do where they have capital punishment in countries for murder. Now, someone will say, well, wait a minute now. What about King David? Well, that's a good point, isn't it? And you will find all the way through the law, every now and then, a glimpse of grace. Because as we've already seen, even in the law and the prophets, the gospel is preached. Are you preaching a double standard? No. I'm saying there are those times. We're also by the authority of God. Man doesn't get what he deserves. Nevertheless, there's a principle here and a responsibility for those who scheme, premeditated, and take another's life. That government has a responsibility. Verse 15, anyone who attacks his father or mother must be put to death. And in the context, the idea is that if you strike your mom and dad and kill them, then you need to be put to death. Anyone who kidnaps another and either sells him or still has him when he is caught must be put to death. Wow, pretty serious in regard to what you do with another human being.
That's right.
Anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. Now, if this law were in place today, certainly this would be a very small service tonight. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be teaching. But it does show us the seriousness of respect for those in authority. And this one, of course, is tied into Exodus chapter 20, verse 12. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. And if you lived under the law, this law, you curse mom and dad, you're done for. Solves a lot of problems of disrespect, doesn't it? If men quarrel and one hits the other with a stone or with his fist and he does not die but is confined to bed, the one who struck the blow will not be held responsible if the other gets up and walks around outside with his staff. In other words, if he didn't hit him that hard, you know. However, he must pay the injured man for the loss of his time and see that he is completely healed. He's responsible. Verse 20, if a man beats his male or female slave with a rod and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. And in the context, it seems like it would be death. But he is not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is his property. I'll just move on from that one. If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. And the court has to be involved here because the husband would, you know, get a Stella Award. But if there is serious injury, you're to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Some people misinterpret this law, because the purpose of this law, when there is serious injury, is to keep from someone looking to take vengeance. And whenever someone's out to take vengeance, you will always want to go beyond what's been done to you. They punch you, you know, a couple of times, and you're going to punch them 8 times. You know, you want vengeance. You don't want to get even. And so this law is to protect that the punishment meets the crime. Verse 26, if a man hits a manservant or maidservant in the eye and destroys it, he must let the servant go free to compensate for the eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of a manservant or maidservant, he must let the servant go free to compensate for the tooth. Well, if you were a slave and you really didn't like your master, you might want to try to provoke him to take your best shot. Then you know you get to go free. If a bull, Al Gore's a man, If a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull must be stoned to death and its meat must not be eaten. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it pinned up and it kills a man or woman, the bull must be stoned and the owner also must be put to death. However, if payment is demanded of him, he may redeem his life by paying whatever is demanded. This law also applies if the bull gores a son or a daughter. If the bull gores a male or female slave, the owner must pay 30 shekels of silver to the master of the slave, and the bull must be stoned. That's the value they put on slaves. Interesting, that's how much Jesus was sold for. If a man uncovers a pit or digs one and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit must pay for the loss. He must pay its owner, and the dead animal will be his. Now, that's good and bad. So somebody digs a pit, your animal falls into it and dies, and so the guy's got to pay, and you also get the animal. And if it's a big animal, you wonder how in the world you can get that dude out of the hole. One of the things I loved to do when I was a kid is dig holes. We dug some of the deepest holes, and then when I saw the movie The Great Escape, we hooked our holes together. We put these boards down in tunnels, and we had skateboards, and we'd pull them through one tunnel to another. And I could not understand why, especially this one guy, Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee lived a couple of doors down from us. And I dug a hole in between our house and his house, and there was a field in between. And he came out one day, and I must have been about 8 foot down in this thing, you know. And he looked down, and he got all over me for digging this hole. One note, was I going to cover it up? And I, of course, said, well, no. And I could not understand why you'd want to cover it up. And then after a couple of kids fell in the hole, I understood. And I got in trouble for digging the hole. If a man's bull injures the bull of another and it dies, they're to sell the live one and divide both the money and the dead animal equally. However, if it was known that the bull had the habit of goring, yet the owner did not keep it pinned up, the owner must pay animal for animal and the dead animal will be his. It's a great study, isn't it? Chapter 22. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Remember what Zacchaeus said the day that Jesus went to his house. If I've cheated anybody, I'll pay him back fourfold. He understood some of these principles of the law. If a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, he's guilty of bloodshed. Well, what does that mean? It means that if somebody breaks in and it's night, and they didn't have lights like we have lights. And so here you are, you know, and you grab, you know, whatever's near, and you're defending your household, and you don't know who it is. You don't know how big they are. All you hear is somebody, and boom, you start swinging. What if after you turn the lights on, you see that it's a 12-year-old kid? And if it were light, you would have seen that it's a 12-year-old kid. And the idea is, again, God is setting perimeters here, not only for the one being protected, but also for the criminal. It's interesting what we do with thieves. God's method is restitution. Our method is just to lock them up. Just put them in a cage. And it's against God's principles. We'll come back to that at the end. A thief must certainly make restitution, but if he has nothing, he must be sold to pay for his theft. If the stolen animal is found alive in his possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, he must pay back double. If a man grazes his livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray, and they graze in another man's field, he must make restitution from the best of his own field or vineyard. If a fire breaks out, spreads in the thorn bushes so that it burns shocks of grain or standing grain or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make restitution. If a man gives his neighbor silver or goods for safekeeping and they're stolen from the neighbor's house, the thief, if he is caught, must pay back double. But if the thief is not found, the owner of the house must appear before the judges to determine whether he has laid his hands on the other man's property. In all cases of illegal possession of an ox, a donkey, a sheep, a garment, or any other lost property about which somebody says, "This is mine," both parties are to bring their cases before the judges. And the one whom the judges declare guilty must pay back double to his neighbor. This also would stop a lot of thievery. You're not only making restitution, you're doubling it. And sometimes more than that. If a man gives a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any other animal to his neighbor for safekeeping, and it dies or is injured or is taken away while no one is looking, the issue between them will be settled by the taking of an oath before the Lord that the neighbor did not lay hands on the other man's property. The owner is to accept this, and no restitution is required. That's a tough one for some of us, but unless you have proof, and the person, especially a brother in the Lord, a sister in the Lord, says, "I did not do it." Unless you have proof, you're to believe them. But, verse 12, if the animal was stolen from the neighbor, he must make restitution to the owner. If it was torn to pieces by a wild animal, he shall bring in the remains as evidence, and he will not be required to pay for the torn animal. If a man borrows an animal from his neighbor, and it's injured or dies while the owner is not present, he must make restitution. So there's tremendous responsibility, even for your neighbor. But if the owner is with the animal, the borrower will not have to pay. If the animal was hired, the money paid for the hire covers the loss. These last ones will wake a couple of you up. If a man seduces a virgin who is not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price and she shall be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he must still pay the bride price for virgins. This law right here would stop a lot of fornication. Don't allow sorceress to live. Meddling in witchcraft and things connected with witchcraft. Anyone who has sexual relations with an animal must be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed. Don't mistreat an alien or oppress him, for you were aliens in Egypt. Don't take advantage of a widow or an orphan. If you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. God has in his heart tremendous concern and compassion for the poor and the needy, for the orphan and the widow. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, don't be like a money lender. Charge him no interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. What else will he sleep in? When he cries out to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. Don't blaspheme God or curse the ruler of your people. This is the one Paul referred to when, after being struck at the command of the high priest, he said, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. And somebody said, you dare to insult God's high priest? And then this scripture came to his mind. And he said, it is written, don't speak evil of the ruler of your people. respect, even for someone who was ungodly, but because they were in authority, an established authority by God. Don't hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats. The temptation would be, in a bumper year, that now you held back. And now you didn't give as you should give. And you begin to become stingy with how God has blessed you. Don't hold back offerings from your granaries or your vats. You must give me the firstborn of your sons. Do the same with your cattle and your sheep. Let them stay with their mothers for 7 days, but give them to me on the eighth day. That principle is the principle of the first fruits. That the first fruits of all God gives us belongs to Him. Does that mean the second fruits don't belong to Him? No. But that first fruit, listen, your firstborn child, while you love all your children, there's something you have to admit special about that first child. And sometimes we want to hold back of things that are so precious to us in giving them to the Lord. Don't hold back. Whether it's your wealth, whether it's those personal possessions, even those children that God has given us. The best thing you can do for your children is offer them to the Lord. You're to be my holy people. So do not eat the meat of an animal torn by wild beast. Throw it to the dogs. I thought that last one is a great verse talking about kids. Maybe some manners at the table were to eat, not like wild beasts. A lot of laws. I'm sure you want to read through them again tomorrow morning during your devotions. Some of them obviously interpreted in a cultural setting. Nevertheless, the principles behind these laws, there are four reasons God gives laws. And I'm done. I'm not going to prolong it. You don't have to. Of course, you can't go to sleep in here. It's freezing, isn't it? There are four purposes for law. And for authority. And they're all good. Law is not bad. Sometimes we misunderstand and think, well, law is bad. Law is not bad. Law is good. Unfortunately, we're living in a day where they're looking to borrow from ungodly countries that have no Judeo-Christian ethic about them at all. And we're moving in America away from the biblical foundation for lawmaking. Laws established by God are for protection. All these laws are meant to protect. And they protect not only the one that's sinned against, but they protect the sinner. They're also for provision. Laws. God's laws, when you are wrong, that the purpose of the moral code and the itemized laws that go with that moral code is that the wrong that has been done to you is righted by the person that's done you the wrong. Provision. And third, for punishment. There are those that choose to continue to rebel against law. And law will be and should be their downfall. I'm sorry to say too, we're living in a day where sometimes we're just slapping somebody on the wrist and there's no real punishment for the crime. And so because there's no real punishment in so many situations, there's no real deterrent. And it's a shame. And the fourth reason for law is for purity. Purity. The law is holy. The law is righteous. I got on one website before I close in prayer. And some of the latest statistics. As things now stand, crime is not a particularly risky activity. Only one person out of every five arrested for a violent felony is subsequently convicted and then sentenced to at least a year in prison. Only 49% of those arrested for homicide serve a term of 1 year or more, and for rapists the figure is 29%. Criminals who are incarcerated typically spend just over 2 years in confinement, serving only one-third of their sentences on average. Four out of every five state prison inmates are repeat offenders. Almost half of them are in the midst of at least their fourth sentence. Only eight new convicts were put behind bars in 1993 for every 100 violent crimes carried out during the year. Now, in case you are about to misunderstand what I'm reading here, I'm not for what they conclude at the end of this article. Policy analysts who have studied these figures are left with one response. To keep predators away from society, build more prisons. No. No. Do we need prison? Perhaps for some things, yes. But if we go back to some biblical foundation, if we go back to some biblical precedent, the answer, what a foolish answer to just lock them away for year after year after year after year. If we get some biblical principles. God bless Chuck Colson. I think he's written a book. I forget the name of it. But they've actually applied some biblical principles in places. And he's tried to get, you know, our government to wake up and smell the coffee and apply some biblical principles to some of our legal system. And it's not totally a wash. But my goodness, it's not working. And that's obvious. So what do we do? I'll tell you one thing you do. You pray for revival. That's one thing you do. You pray for revival. And the second thing you do is you look forward to the coming Prince of Peace. I'll just read you two scriptures. Isaiah chapter 9. You might want to look at it with me. If you look at it with me, I might close. Verse 6. For to us a child is born, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. Verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. And he'll reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. What a great day it's going to be when Jesus comes. And he sets up his standard. And it says he'll rule with a rod of iron. Zechariah says, if you choose not to, as a nation, worship the king, then you won't get any rain. And that's a good incentive to worship the king. But that's really not the kind of worship he's looking for, is it? Is he looking for the kind of worship that's motivated by a bunch of do's and don'ts? Well, no. But because now the law is in our heart, because Christ dwells within us, we want to be responsible. We want to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And we're going to probably skip the whole Bible study and just go on back to Jesus' statement. The two greatest commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And the second one is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. You know what? If we can do those two things, and one day we will, completely, when he comes, and we have our new bodies, we won't need a law. If you can do those two things, you don't need a law. Because then the fruit of the Spirit begins to operate in your life. And whoever got arrested for showing kindness. There's a law against showing kindness. You're showing too much kindness. There's no law against love. There's no law against the fruit of the Spirit. So Father, thank you for your law. It represents morality. It represents righteousness. It represents responsibility. And Lord, as we look at these detailed laws that you gave to the children of Israel, we understand that while each one of them doesn't necessarily culturally apply to us, we know the principles behind them are eternal. So Lord, may we love you, and may we love one another, and may we submit to the laws that you've established because we have that kind of heart. Lord, make this place, Calvary Chapel, a taste of heaven every time we get together. Lord, may the divorce just totally turn around in the church. Lord, may our crimes against one another as brothers and sisters, may it be such a shame. Lord, do a work in your church. Thank you for your law. In Jesus' name, amen.